I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the U.S. is to provide millions for the Syrian opposition. The Syrian humanitarian crisis is stretching the U.N.'s response capacity.
We have heard all the pledges. We now need to see that those pledges are honored. The High Commissioner is operating on a shoestring compared to the needs that are in the region.
Turkey provides schools for Syrian refugee children. And reaction to agreement on more talks concerning Iran's nuclear program. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced $60 million in additional aid to the Syrian opposition. And also, for the first time, an unspecified amount of non-lethal aid to some of its military forces. VOA's Al Pessin reports from Rome, where Kerry attended a meeting with opposition leaders and officials from dozens of countries supporting them.
Secretary Kerry says the $60 million will enable the Syrian opposition to provide services in areas it controls and help build its local support. Militant groups have filled that role in some areas, raising concerns in the West. The military aid, combat rations, and medical supplies will be the first provided by the United States directly to the opposition military council. The Syrian opposition wants weapons and was hoping at least for equipment like body armor and armored vehicles. The United States is concerned about any supplies being passed to the militants, who have many of the most effective fighting units. At a news conference Thursday after what is called the Friends of Syria meeting, Kerry referred to the concern about militants and the balance the international community is trying to strike between pressing for an end to the Assad regime and not strengthening the extremists.
We can't risk letting this country in the heart of the Middle East be destroyed by vicious autocrats or hijacked by the extremists. In supporting the Syrian Opposition Coalition and the Free Syrian Army, we reject both of those choices.
Kerry has said the United States wants to change the calculation Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is making as he clings to power and orders increasingly brutal attacks on civilian areas. He was asked how this limited aid will do that.
What we're doing today is part of a whole, and I am very confident that that whole is going to have the ability for President Assad to realize he better start measuring more effectively what his future is, what his choices are, and what kinds of weapons he uses. So I'm very confident in what the President has put forward today as the beginning of a process that will, in fact, change his calculation.
The president of the Syrian Opposition Council, Muaz al-Khatib, spoke forcefully at the news conference, calling on President Assad to stop bombing civilian areas and expressing impatience with his foreign supporters, who he believes are overly concerned about their aid falling into the hands of terrorists. He's heard through an interpreter.
No terrorists in the world have such a savage nature as that of the Syrian regime.
The meeting's communique says the coalition will soon appoint someone to head an interim government that would operate inside Syria. Al Pessin, VOA News, Rome.
The chief United Nations humanitarian official says the Syrian fighting is stretching the UN's ability to respond. Larry Freund reports from New York.
Valerie Amos, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, briefed the UN Security Council on the situation in Syria. She then emerged from the closed-door meeting to tell reporters that the Syrian crisis is completely stretching the UN's capacity.
Quite frankly, the pace at which we're able to do this is much slower than the pace at which the crisis is evolving. I am also extremely concerned by the rising costs of this. I mean, we asked for $1.5 billion for our response for the next 6 months. Those figures are already out of date, given the projections we had at the end of last year and where we are now.
Amos said the first 2 months of this year have been what she called a real game changer, and she said the scale of the humanitarian crisis is outpacing whatever is done to respond. Another humanitarian official, Udo Jans from the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, said we might be reaching a moment of reckoning in the region because of the impact of Syrian refugees on neighboring countries. Jans said since early January, every week about 40,000 Syrians have fled their country.
We could be talking now about 400,000 refugees in both Lebanon and in Jordan. We are approaching 300,000 in Turkey, and over 100,000 have already made their way to Iraq, and there are thousands of others who have made their way further beyond into Europe and North Africa.
Jans added that more than 30,000 Palestinians, once hosted by Syria, have made their way into Lebanon.
We have heard all the pledges. We now need to see that those pledges are honored. The High Commissioner is operating on a shoestring compared to the needs that are in the region.
At a conference in Kuwait on January 30th, the UN reached its goal of $1.5 billion in aid pledges. However, UN Humanitarian Chief Amos said the UN has received only $200 million of the pledged money. For VOA News, this is Larry Freund in New York.
As Syrian refugees flee the conflict in their nation to northern Iraq, they reportedly are walking into more danger. The Mines Advisory Group says landmines still contaminate northern Iraq. They have initiated an emergency clearance effort and are trying to educate refugees about warning signs. We asked Jennifer Lockman, executive director of MAG America, what the Syrian civilians can do.
They need to know what the warning signs are is the main thing. So because the area is so contaminated and we haven't had the opportunity to clear all of the land, areas that are still minefields, still dangerous, we put up a sign. It's a trademark skull and crossbone sign that means danger mines. And we'll demarcate the area so that populations know that they should not cross into that area because it is dangerous. So we give them education on those warning signs. We also tell them if they do find any item of unexploded ordnance or see a landmine, that they want to report that information back to MAG so that we can make sure to clear it as quickly as possible.
Have the refugees shared any of their stories with your workers?
They have. They're very grateful when they cross into northern Iraq that MAG is there to provide them with this education and that we've done this clearance so that they can be safe. But they do share stories of how tremendous their journey has been over the past several days, weeks. Many of them are coming from the northern towns in Syria. Some of them are coming all the way from Damascus. Some of them have been traveling for days without food or water. So they're very happy to be coming to an area where there's assistance.
And how long will you stay there working in the area?
As long as we need to. We've been working in northern Iraq since 1992, so we have a well-established program there that before the Syrian refugees came, we're focusing on the local populations, and we continue to do that work. In terms of the support we're providing to the Syrian refugees, we'll stay there as long as they need assistance and as long as we can ensure their protection.
Jennifer Lockman, executive director of MAG America, speaking with us from her Washington offices. As the Syrian conflict approaches the end of its second year, authorities in neighboring Turkey have set up schools for refugee children. Most schools are in camps, where some 200,000 Syrian refugees now live. But for the thousands who are living in apartments or with extended family, no schooling was available until recently. VOA's Scott Bob reports from a town 50 kilometers north of the Syrian border.
Gaziantep School for Syrian Refugees. These fourth graders are studying in their native Arabic, though their coursework follows Turkey's curriculum. They also are learning the Turkish and English languages. The school was opened in October when it became clear that they would not be going home anytime soon. Nearly 600 Syrian children study in the 8 classrooms here, the younger ones in the morning, the older ones in the afternoon. At night, more than 300 parents come to learn Turkish. Like most children, these kids love to draw. Many drawings show disturbing scenes. Director Orhan Buyukaslan says art helps them deal with trauma.
As you see in the drawings, the children have witnessed war, fighting, violence, bombings. They and their families are tense. They can start shouting, fighting, even over little things. We understand what's going on inside them. That's why we tolerate it.
The Gaziantep city government funds the school and pays student expenses. Mayor Asim Güzelbey says the presence of so many foreigners can cause tensions, but he says local people remember Turkey's suffering following the First World War.
Gaziantep has seen terrible war, where 25% of its population was killed. The people here know what it's like to lose everything and survive without food. That's why we understand the Syrian situation. We have embraced them.
Onun için yokluğun ve savaşın ne demek olduğunu bu şehir çok iyi biliyor.
Güzelbey is disturbed by the humanitarian suffering and the destruction in Syria, which shows no sign of ending soon. As classes end, the Syrian children are dismissed, leaving Gaziantep officials to worry about how to possibly handle thousands more waiting to escape the violence engulfing their country. Scott Bob, VOA News, Gaziantep, Turkey.
VOA invites you to share a glimpse of your life through photography and become eligible to win a new iPad. VOA helps give you insights into the world. Now we want to share your world with us. Send us your best photos, ones that capture the spirit or the essence of the people and places in your life. VOA judges will choose a winner. For a complete list of contest rules, go to voanews.com/iPad. As we've been reporting, Iran and six world powers have agreed to more talks about the Iranian nuclear program after negotiators offered new concessions. This came at the end of a two-day meeting Wednesday of Iranian and world power representatives in Kazakhstan, where they engaged in their first high-level talks since last June. The talks have been aimed at addressing Western concerns that Iran is secretly developing nuclear weapons under the cover of a peaceful energy program, a charge Tehran denies. Diplomats said the world powers proposed lifting sanctions on Iranian gold and other precious metals in return for Iran suspending the enrichment of uranium to 20% purity at its Fordo underground facility. Previously, the six nations had limited their offers to ending restrictions on spare parts for Iranian civilian airliners. They also had insisted on a full shutdown of the Fordo complex. The parties agreed to hold an expert-level meeting on March 18th in Istanbul, Turkey, followed by another meeting of top negotiators starting April 5th. VOA correspondent Bijan Farhoudi in Almaty said sources told him that the request for a speedy resumption of negotiations came from Iran.
A senior U.S. official in Almaty said there is no deadline per se, but Iran knows that the time is running short and it must accept the demands of the world community very soon, or other options might come into play, which are not very attractive. So the best option that the world community and Iran can have in this matter is diplomatic to get it resolved. The P5 plus one is hoping that Iran has come to a realization that this thing has to be resolved, but they are not sure what Iran's real intentions are.
Iran's economy has weakened under the sanctions, with key oil revenues falling, unemployment rising, and inflation soaring. EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton, who represented the six nations, said she hopes the Iranian side will look at their new proposal positively.
The E3 plus 3 has tabled a revised proposal, which we believe is balanced and a fair basis for constructive talks. The offer addresses international concerns on the exclusively peaceful nature of the Iranian nuclear program, but is also responsive to Iranian ideas. We approach this with absolutely united view that we need to see the progress that's necessary for the confidence that the international community needs in this program. And I hope that when we meet again, we will have seen that Iran has picked up these proposals and is pushing to make that progress with us.
Daryl Kimball, executive director of the U.S.-based Arms Control Association, says he was surprised by Iran's eagerness to keep talking.
The details are thin at this time. However, you know, look good in the sense that both sides seem to be more positive about what one another said and offered. It's clear that Iran wants sanctions relief from the devastating international and national sanctions that are in place, but it's clear that the P5 plus one group is not going to ease up on that pressure until Iran takes some very tangible steps. It's going to take a serious and sustained series of talks to achieve a breakthrough, but you know, there's time for diplomacy, but there's not a lot of time.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Wednesday that the international community should intensify existing Iranian sanctions and warned Tehran that continued uranium enrichment will lead to military sanctions. He did not elaborate. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.